This is Victor Schoenbeck. Today is January the 17th, 2011. I'm sitting here with Bert Kaplan, Dr. Burton H. Kaplan, to talk about some of his experiences at UNC and some of the history of the Department of Epidemiology. So, Bert, if you want to just confirm that this is being recorded with your permission and that we can disseminate this recording on the internet in other ways?
It is being recorded with my enthusiastic imprimatur. I don't have a medieval seal to stamp it with, but I'm glad to be here. Are you going to get somebody to type it from this?
Probably not, except maybe little excerpts. That's a lot of time and expense. And what I want to do, what I want to do is put it on the web, or at least sections of it. I came across some material that Carl Shai distributed about the early years of the department, meaning in the early 1950s, when the only faculty member was McGavern. He said 10% faculty in the Department of Epidemiology and then 90% dean.
Yeah.
And he described it as...
He was the only member, wasn't he?
That's right. And he was teaching all these courses. It's really quite incredible. So...
He had the son of missionaries, I think, to India. And he had the... he saw public health as his secular mission. Great man. Very skilled at choosing strategic people for leadership positions and then essentially leaving them alone. Like the first head of ESC was not Dan Okun, it was, what was his name? I really didn't know him that well. John Castle came, actually Clark was the first head, and Castle had been Clark's student. And Lucy Morgan was chairman of health education, and Stewart took her role when she
took her place. Yeah, let me start with a little bit of your biography. I know you've told me where you were born and grew up and went to school, but you were born in 1933.
I was born on the 27th of June, 1930, in Winchester Memorial Hospital. In those days, I think my mother was there at least a week. The model was that you need a lot of rest afterwards. Today, I think they're up and at them right away. And I grew up in a nearby town, 18 miles away, Strasburg, Virginia. A small town whose economy was rooted in the world of lime, crushed rock, seed corn, and apple orchards, vast apple orchards. A quote, silk mill came from New Jersey. And much, much later, a larger spinning mill, nylon, not silk, was in a nearby town of Front Royal. And in the process of the coming of an industrial base, came the large Safeways and so on. That's both good for our community, as I saw it as a kid, but I also watched these large enterprises gradually destroy the small businessman. One of them included my father, but it affected everybody. Walmart is a contemporary giant of that destructive process. It's very good for people who hold Walmart stock, but not for people in small communities. I was on a university committee once examining what is the university's role in helping preserve the economies of small communities, chaired by a distinguished member of the planning department. In rural Virginia at that time, they didn't have 12 grades. They had 11. So I knew I was headed for Virginia Tech. I knew that you had to have 2 years of geometry. So another, out of 50 students, only two of us were headed to college. Two of my classmates went to Bible colleges. They wanted to be missionaries or something like that. So we sat in the back of the room and taught each other plane and solid geometry, a subject which I happen to absolutely love. It is an art form. It's aesthetic. It's beautiful. So I used to love to go to the blackboard and put up proofs. And I went to Virginia Tech at age 16, which meant that when I got there, I was still, in terms of science education, a year behind everybody else. I wasn't behind in terms of language, because I had the good fortune of Reverend Harry Krim, Presbyterian minister, and I had become good friends. And I asked him if I could borrow from his library. There was no library in Strasburg. There was essentially no library in the high school. So I eagerly went through everything in his library, book by book. He said, there's one book you can't read until you're 16. And I said, what is that? From the Revolutionary period. The title is... He was the voice of Thomas Paine was his name, and the name of the book was what, The Age of Dissent? Does that sound right?
That could be.
But it was a book arguing for a democratic process. And
that he didn't want you to read?
And I asked him later, why did you exclude that book? He said, I wasn't trying to be a censor. I didn't want to upset your parents. And I said, I don't think I understand that. He said, well, Paine was a dissenter to establish religions of all sorts. And I didn't want to take the chance that he might have that effect on you. I told him not to worry. But he was the philosopher of the American Revolution. And it fit because 60 to 70% of the signatories of the United States Constitution were dissenters, or Unitarians, or freethinkers.
Deists.
Deists. Yeah, they're now called it Unitarians. I think that's the right transition. Virginia Tech was where my older brothers had gone, and it was affordable. I paid $25 a quarter for 4 years, and meals were $1.20 a day. I think the dorm room was $12-$15 a month. I worked, except for the first year, I worked my way through college. I worked in the dining hall of the faculty club as a waiter. Through a bit of luck of someone my mother knew, I had 2 summers in the Catskills. I earned enough. You work from 7 a.m. to 11 p.m. with an hour off from the first week in June to Labor Day. So you usually left the dining hall and fell into bed. But I earned enough in tips from 2 summers to pay for 3 years. So, and when I went, the arrangement I had, or all of us had, was the Korean War had started, and we were told we would be allowed to finish, which gave us about 18 months of college time. I lost 6 of my best friends in Korea. The only reason I didn't end up in Korea when I finally was called to active duty, they had to wait until I was 21. You can't be awarded your commission until you're 21. So I sat there for a while until I turned 21.
Were you in ROTC?
Huh?
Were you in ROTC?
Yeah.
Virginia Tech?
There were 3,000 students, all males, with one exception. And it's all military. The exception were 12 females who were in a architecture program run by Charlottesville and VPI. 6 of the students would receive their degrees from Charlottesville, University of Virginia. The other 6 from Virginia Tech. They lived in a gigantic turn-of-the-century, beautiful stone house that sat in a sort of a lane between the lower military quad and the Ag campus. So it was dubbed the skirt bar, which I thought was a bit of humor. I found that experience very positive.
I
think the average person would find that I know would find a military college an outlier off something they would reject. I didn't reject it, first of all, because I really didn't have a choice, because it was the least expensive place.
Now, wait a second. When you say a military college, do you mean VMI?
No, VMI was up the road in Lexington. They're both universities. I would have guessed that Virginia Tech had a dramatically larger graduate program than VMI, which I thought at the time was overwhelmingly an undergraduate institution. But VMI was where there was a class difference between Virginia Tech and VMI. General Marshall went to VMI. That's where the Virginia aristocratic families sent their future General Lees to VMI, particularly if they didn't get into West Point.
Well, was Virginia Tech a military school?
Yeah, 100%.
Really? I wasn't aware.
Except for those females in the architecture program.
Now, it isn't now, is it, a military
school? No. I went to a class reunion, and about 15, 18 years ago, and I was told that there were 24,000 students at Virginia Tech, which I think is a sort of steady state figure now. But there are only 700-800 in the Cadet Corps.
Now,
and it's dramatically expanded its graduate program.
But at the time, it was a military academy, essentially.
Entirely. Within a few years, veterans could go to Virginia Tech and not be in the Cadet Corps. But they were just coming out of World War II. I do not know the time frame, exact time frame, when they made that huge transition from being entirely a Cadet Corps to the Cadet Corps being a very minor part of the student population. Classmates I had lost and friends I lost in Korea were some of the most amazing people I'd ever met. Claude Foster, who had come from a very poor rural family, became the student steward of the dining hall. I think he majored in agricultural economics. He was killed in Korea. The irony of being in a cadet corps, for me, was that it was very democratic in that you rose in rank contingent on your grades and on your demonstrated leadership ability. And so when I graduated, I had been offered a regular commission, same as graduating from West Point. There were six of us who were, at the risk of hubris, were labeled distinguished military graduates. I have no idea how I earned such a designation, but it meant that for a three-year period, I had the option of a regular commission in either the Army or the Air Force. All I had to do was sign a letter. Even though I was on active duty, I could have either accepted it in the Army or accepted it in the Air Force. I finally decided I couldn't see myself in military career. That didn't fit my temperament. But life is very often structured by sheer luck. I mean, I lucked into that. But when I got my orders to go on active duty in the Air Force, presented myself on the 22nd of August, and as did the orders read, and his title was the intake officer, and he said, "I have no record of you. You're not on my list of incoming staffing, because Canaveral was gearing up for rockets, was gearing up for the space program. At that time, the space program was, the focus was on the lift vehicle. Von Braun used to come about every 2 weeks. He used to analyze that data with a roommate of mine who spoke German, whose parents were Austrian. The Pentagon told the intake officer, according to their records, Kaplan is right now at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. In a week, he will be headed to Korea. And when they looked at that telegram and they looked at the time frame, I was 7 weeks out of sync with the training you got before you went overseas. So the Pentagon wired Cape Canaveral, Patrick, Air Force Base, keep him. He's out of sync with his cohort that are leaving in a week. So the only reason I didn't end up in Korea at a forward Air Force Base, which would have been rather hazardous, was luck. Sheer luck. Life is very often a function of luck. I recommend to everybody I know that they read Salvatore Luria, Life, the Unfinished Experiment, part of which is about the probability, all of the probabilities, starting with the probability of you being you, is unbelievably small. He won a Nobel Prize in genetics in the 1962 or 63. I got to know him when we were on leave at Stanford. His one day at lunch at the faculty club, he took out a napkin from on the table and plotted his family tree. More recently, in his family tree were three other Nobel laureates: Levy Modigliani. I don't remember her first name. Modigliani, I don't remember his first name either, in economics at MIT. And the third relative, these are cousins, Luria. As he traced his family tree, he took me back to the 12th century Spain. His great-great grandfather, if you go back to the 12th century, was the compiler of the Kabbalah, the Jewish manuscript on mysticism. It's very, very difficult reading. But he grew up in the north of Italy. But that book came to mind because part of my story is just damn luck.
It's true for a lot of us. Huh? True for a lot of us. A lot of us. The reason that you were out of sync was that they were waiting for you to be 21 before they...
Oh, that was the first out of sync. But the one that determined my staying at Patrick and Canaveral was that the cohort I should have belonged to had its preliminary training at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Ohio. And they were about to finish that 6 weeks transition. I didn't know how to handle a pistol.
But why didn't you get called along with the rest of your cohort to go to...
Oh, a friend of mine said, you got to remember that in the Air Force it's called career manglement, not career management. I don't know why I got a telegram essentially 6 weeks late. But that's was luck. And so I stayed there, even though I volunteered to go to Korea. It's hard to explain that other than you're in a military school, you become bonded to your brother rats. It's a very intense bonding of social ties that all the military academies forge with a variety of social techniques. But that was luck. But I lucked into the office of base adjutant was not filled, and I was interviewed by the base commander, and he said, I'm going to put you in that slot until I get a replacement, because it's a major or a lieutenant colonel's spot. And he was sufficiently satisfied with me that he promoted me early to a first lieutenant. And so I became the base adjutant. And so I got to see all the shoots. I sat in on all of the planning meetings for the space-related activities. Just the luck of Colonel Good's appraisal of me. He was a wonderful human being, a great man. From Colorado, he had been called up for the Berlin airlift from World War II, and he decided when he got called up for Korea, he would just stay in and get his 20 or 30 years and retire. He loved to fly, and he, by that age, did no longer fly a fighter. He flew transports. So he used to take me along when he would go on a C-54. We would go to Washington, Baltimore, Boston, technology centers of related to the missile program. So it was an MBA kind of experience. I learned a lot.
You didn't fly the planes yourself, did you? You weren't flying. You weren't a pilot, were you?
Along with two of my best friends, who were Naval Academy graduates, we were taking the flight tests that allowed you to go to flight school. And all three of us flunked the depth perception test. And I had this kid's romantic fantasy of being a pilot. At that time, a depth perception test was very important. Now that's done mechanically. It's on the flight deck, and you just push a button and you see everything you need to see graphed in front of you. But then you had depended on depth perception is critical to landing and taking off properly. So I had borrowed money from my parents to finish college. So I paid them off the first year because they weren't that well off. In fact, if it weren't for Social Security, they would have been up the creek. From there, I was interested in social anthropology at the time, and from the homework I had done, the best place to do that in the United States was University of Chicago, no question. That whole Department of Anthropology was social, British style. If you read David Brooks today, he is a product of the University of Chicago program in human development, which is still deeply abides by that social science tradition. Went to Edinburgh for a year and was planning to graduate from there. But my father had a heart attack, and I didn't think I could stay 3 or 4 years away, and I didn't have the funds to go back and forth in the summer. So probably one of the best educational experiences I ever had. The only required course at Edinburgh University at the undergraduate and graduate level, it was epistemology. How do you know anything? Before I sailed, about 6-8 weeks before I sailed, I received in the mail a 94-page book that was a summary of articles in the tradition of David Hume, the inductive method, and you would have an oral exam within the first month when you're there. So it meant you really had to work hard to absorb. If you listen to someone like John Castle, he obviously was schooled in that tradition. That's modern science. One of the great accidents of modern science is that Charles Darwin, when he was 16, his father wrote a letter to the dean of the Edinburgh Infirmary, "I am sending you my son." That's where his father had gone to medical school. There were more medical schools per applicant in Scotland than there were in England. There are at least four medical schools in Scotland, which only has a population of 16, 18 million people. And Charles Darwin found medical school unbelievably boring and discovered two Scottish naturalists at the Edinburgh Museum of Natural History who were studying those kinds of questions. And they had been students of Lyell at Cambridge. So they sent him to Cambridge where he finished his academic training. And he was lucky enough to marry a Wedgwood dishware and so on. So he didn't need a job. His wife's fortune covered his expenses. But
let me come back. So you were at Edinburgh for 1 year? You were at Edinburgh for one year?
1 year.
And then did you come to UNC for
Yeah, there? UNC to finish.
In sociology, though, right?
Yep.
Why did you switch to sociology?
Well, that's about the closest to a social anthropology program as you can get. And this is one of the best settings for that subject. And he had a strong presence here in anthropology as well.
And what year was it that you came here? What year was it you started here in sociology?
56. Mm-hmm. 56. And
when did you first...
My dissertation was in the same tradition of social anthropology.
Right. I remember your dissertation was anthropology rather than sociology, or at least rather than what many of us would think of as sociology. In the mountains? In the mountains. Blue River.
Yeah, Yancey County. And I was offered an instructorship for a year here. And
in sociology?
In epidemiology.
So when did you first encounter the Department of Epidemiology or the people in the department?
They were looking, actually, the first year or two years, they had a Department of Mental Health, John Philly, and he was the only person. And they were looking to develop that program, and they recruited me and a nurse.
Now, this was while you were a student?
No, I had already finished my dissertation. And that didn't work out. And for a whole complex of reasons. And in the meantime, I had gotten to know Bob Wilson, who was a very, very important figure in my own development. I owe him more than I can ever express gratitude. He urged me, given my interests, he urged me to apply for a social science research council fellowship, which is a faculty salary level fellowship. And they only give 10 a year. So I said to him, I've looked over from the material they sent. The odds of my getting this fellowship must be in 0.5%, 0.25%. When I look at the longer list of awardees, your probabilities are higher if you've got a novel to write, a symphony to write. In the social sciences, there were just a few. I think six or eight. And he knew Alex Layton from his Cornell days. Bob came here from Cornell. And I had read everything, just about everything Layton had written, and it fit my interests. And as luck would have it, I won one of those.
Excuse me, just a sec. This was Cornell in Ithaca or Cornell in New
York? I had a choice.
But which did Bob come from? Bob Wilson.
Ithaca.
Ithaca.
I had a choice. I could either do my proposed project, and he wanted me to help him with a book, and I would be sitting in on various seminars related to the future of the Sterling Project, which was the oldest and longest lived psychiatric epidemiology program in the country, perhaps in the world, with the exception of one or two programs in Sweden and Denmark. And when I looked at how much an apartment costs in the area of the New York Hospital and Cornell Medical School, and how much it would cost to live in Ithaca, that was an easy decision. I was not about to live in a suburbs and spend 2 hours a day commuting. So we had an apartment in the back of Sapsucker Woods, the birding sanctuary laboratory for the Cornell Ornithology program. So we spent a year there, and I was invited to teach summer school. That was a marvelous experience.
So you were in Cornell, at Cornell, working with Alex Layton for how many
a year?
Years? A year.
And that they left for Harvard, and for a decade I continued to work with him, and I would commute about every other week.
In that decade, where were you then? Were you still? You weren't still at Cornell, were you? When you were for that decade, were you at Cornell?
No, I was in the department here, but I continued to work on that project with Alex.
Mm-hmm. So when did you leave Cornell? How did you go from Cornell to UNC?
Well, I was only there a year.
And did you have a connection to UNC?
No, I was in the department by that time of epidemiology.
So you were at Cornell and then you applied to epidemiology?
I got a telephone call from John Castle saying, I don't want to get into the story of the destiny of the extinct Department of Mental Health, which I was not any longer interested in for a host of reasons. But when John Castle offered me an opportunity in epidemiology, that was a godfather offer. And I got a call from Chancellor Sitterson urging me to come back, which was a great surprise to me. I had an offer of an assistant professorship at Cornell, which is one of the most intellectually stimulating places I'd ever been. It's two universities in one. The upper part of the campus is agricultural sciences. They have had great strengths in all the social sciences. It was a capstone experience.
But what led John Castle to call? I mean, I'm sure he called you because of your eminence, but what led him to call you? Had you spoken with him before?
I had attended his seminars. I hadn't spoken to him about anything specific. But I didn't know about the plans for the Department of Mental Health, which expires soon after.
Not soon after, because...
Well, not soon after. Dorothea became chairman, but it didn't last beyond her.
Right, basically. It's in the mid-70s. Because it was there in the 70s.
And it had a couple of students.
Mm-hmm. Dave Keel was one, actually.
Huh?
David Keel was one. Do you know David?
He's the only one I remember. It was...
But I want to. This was the part I wanted. One thing I wanted to clarify. So you were. So in 56, you enrolled in sociology, and you finished there in a few years.
Yeah.
58, 9.
I finished in sociology. It's dated 62, but that's the lag between when you defend a dissertation and when you actually get your diploma.
So you defended.
I finished almost a year earlier.
In 61.
Yeah.
And then, was it at that point that you got in touch with Bob Wilson?
Oh, he got in touch with me.
Or he got in touch with you.
And I had been talking to him.
Okay.
And
that's when he suggested that you learn about John Castle?
Yeah, and he suggested a Social Science Research Council fellowship would motivate my career. He had been a member of the Social Science Research Council administrative staff for about 3 years at one time in his career. He didn't know who they awarded this or that to. He just knew its mission.
But so when did you attend John Castle seminars? Do you remember
that? Oh, I started doing that when I was a graduate student in sociology, whenever I could, because they were very stimulating. I think the first time I went, sitting at the end of the table, watching him and listening to the way he thought, I said to myself, he talks like someone with a Talmudic education, which turns out to be true. But that's the way he sounded, a kind of thinking, that kind of imagination, and that kind of freedom of imagination, and that kind of attitude towards arguments. He loved to have debates. John Fulton was designated the role of the devil's advocate if no one else took it. Because he didn't want a seminar that didn't have a competing point of view. And Fulton loved to do that. He was a very bright man, a dentist. John Castle told me that I want 50% of your time for the department and the Evans County. He wanted me for the Evans County project. If they didn't have me, they would have had to have gotten someone else to do the follow up social environment questionnaire, which I did almost from scratch, because the first version needed a lot of editing. Actually, don't know who was responsible for the first time around. I tried to put it on the same kind of intellectual platform that was consistent with the University of Michigan Survey Research Center, which at that time was undoubtedly the best how do you measure these social environment questions? Columbia would have been an Lazarsfeld group would have been an alternate setting. Berkeley would have been an alternate setting. But I thought the Survey Research Center at Ann Arbor was in a league of its own, still is.
So let me back up. You started attending John Castle seminars. This would have been the end of the 1950s or 1960?
I started attending in, let's say, 58 or 59.
And do you remember who else was on the epidemiology faculty then?
Castle brought with him Sloan.
Cecil Sloan. Had Al Tiroler arrived then?
Oh, Tiroler arrived perhaps a year later. They had, Tiroler was with Champion Paper near Asheville. He was their, quote, industrial epidemiologist for their workforce. So he didn't have an academic appointment at the time. But John thought Al was just the sort of person he needed, and he recruited him.
Now, Al was a physician in the Air Force. Am I making that up?
Yeah, but I don't know anything about his military experience.
I have this vague recollection that somebody ended up having his physical done by Al Tiroler.
Yeah, but I don't know anything about his military.
Okay. I can't remember who it was. It wasn't you then, clearly. Okay.
No, he was in the service, but I don't know anything about that.
So was John Fulton was there then, or he came later?
John Fulton, I'd say 1960.
And what about Ralph Patrick?
61 or 62.
And when did you actually join the faculty there? Was it?
62 or 63. You see, I came, about 62, and then I left from 65 to 66 to go to Cornell.
You were on the epi faculty before you went to Cornell?
No, I was in the Department of Mental Health.
Oh, you were. So what was your role in the Department of Mental Health? I guess I missed that.
I was a resident social epidemiologist, the only one.
So and you never had epidemiology, did you?
No. No, but I had had a course in survey research, which uses the same techniques, models, and so on. But I didn't know any epidemiology. I learned that from Castle. If you've had a really good survey research course, you've covered most of the same ground. You're interested in the same methodological questions.
So you got your degree in sociology and you went to the Department of Mental Health and you became the resident social epidemiologist. Were you a faculty member or was it a faculty
member? I became a faculty member full time when I came back from Cornell.
Okay, so you were in some other, it was like a research associate or a
No, I was an assistant professor.
But before Cornell?
Yeah, but it was in the... But it was in the Department of Mental Health, but I was already spending more time in epidemiology than I was in mental health, which was agreeable to everybody. And I wasn't that happy in the Department of Mental Health for a host of reasons that are too personal to record. Not too personal to tell you privately, but too personal to record.
Okay.
Let me increase a little heat.
Okay.
I didn't have arthritis until about a year ago. And it's all in the stiffness in my legs. And cold weather is not good for that.
Mm.
So it's cooling off.
Mm-hmm. So you were on the faculty in mental health, and you worked with folks in epidemiology on Evans County, I guess.
I devoted a big chunk of my career to the Evans County study.
And when you came back from Cornell, who else was on the faculty of that? I mean, you mentioned Ralph Patrick was there already, and John Fulton, and John Castle, and Al Tiroler. Was there anybody else already on the faculty? Was Barbara Hulka there already? Or did she come after you?
He was from Britain. What was his
Tony
name?
McMichael?
Huh?
Tony McMichael, was he there?
No. Tony spent a year as a postdoc, and he went back to Australia, but soon after that he went to Britain.
Mm-hmm.
The same is true of the director of the Whitehall study.
Oh, Michael Marmot?
Yeah. Yeah, Mike's family background is very similar to mine. Lithuanian Jews, but they went to Australia, mine came here. And Mike got his epidemiological training in Britain and stayed and became a British subject. He may have gone back to Australia a bit, but his after his training, he has spent his life in Great Britain.
And Tony, another New Zealander, Australian, Tony...
McMichaels.
I'm sorry, I thought his name was Tony. I'm thinking of the other... There was another one of those, I mean, from that era, who did a 1 year, I think. Then he went out to California. Maybe his name will come back to me later. I'm embarrassed. I don't remember it.
Yeah, I know who you mean. I didn't know him that well.
So your years at Cornell were 60...
65 to 66.
5 to 66, and then you came
and
back
I
to
spent
UNC.
The summer. I spent the summer teaching, and I was invited back a couple of years later to teach in the summer.
But so you were on the UNC Epi faculty,
yeah,
in 66.
Yeah.
And was David Jenkins there then?
Oh, yeah. David... when did David Jenkins... come to the department about the same time I did,
mm-hmm,
give or take a year.
Mm-hmm.
But he was a student in the Department of Psychology here, and I do not know his exact year, but when he was a student finishing his dissertation, he was already beginning to spend some seminar time in epidemiology. And John wanted a psychologist. He wanted all the social sciences represented, sociology, anthropology, psychology. That was a model Karp had impressed upon him for modern epidemiology and the modern diseases related to lifestyle.
And so Barbara came after you?
Yeah.
Like in 60, well, I guess I can
find out. I don't know the exact year.
I can find out from her. But then also Carl Shai, he came a little later, I think.
Yeah, but I think Carl Shai was originally the director of environmental studies and environmental sciences. And he came from that.
You know, I came across John Castle's lectures from 1972, from fall of 72, because he gave them out in typed form.
Yeah.
So I've scanned them and put them on the web. I'm going to try to clean them up a little
bit. Oh, that's great.
It's just so edifying to read his words.
Oh, he wrote, he's a very clear thinker.
Mm-hmm.
And he wrote very well.
Mm-hmm.
Master teacher. And he taught with passion. He was taken in the peak of his career. Cancer, right?
I think lymphoma, if I remember correctly.
No, that's correct. But Jeremy Clark told me that Castle's mother or father died of the same thing.
Do you remember when he first taught EPI 160?
Immediately after he got here. What was that? It would have been 1960?
58? I think he came.
Huh?
I think he came in 58.
Okay. Then
I should look that
yeah,
up.
Yeah, he started right off.
And when did you first teach in EPI 160?
Probably 1962.
So you were running a lab back then, all the faculty
yeah,
ran?
Yeah. I did one, I helped with one of the labs.
Mm-hmm.
Now that was a great era.
The school really had a mission in those years.
Yeah.
And
exactly.
from before.
Michelle Ibrahim had been a graduate student in biostatistics. And this is what Michelle told me. He came to realize that he did not have the background to complete a PhD in biostatistics. And apparently discussed this with Bernie Greenberg, who arranged for him to come to epidemiology, where he got a PhD and was kept. There were several students from Egypt, not all at the same time.
Do you remember when Abdul Omran came?
Because
he was there
later.
He was there in 1972, I remember.
Yeah, I'd say the late 60s. Did he not come from Colombia?
I actually don't know.
I don't really know either. That's the first attempt at memory on my part. But I think he'd been in the Columbia School of Public Health program, epidemiology program. He, of course, had a medical degree from an Egyptian university, but I don't think he ever practiced medicine here.
And Ed Wagner was here then, wasn't he? Or not?
I don't have a clear recollection of the time frame for him.
Yeah.
You?
No, I'm trying. I've been trying to think. I know he was here in the late 70s.
Yeah.
Maybe the mid 70s, and I don't remember if he was here in the early 70s. But he was a student first before he became a faculty member.
That's right.
He once confessed at his going away party.
That's right.
He confessed he had never written his master's paper, major paper.
Yeah.
So
it's,
that was before Joyce Allen. Joyce Allen said, well, it must have been before I was registrar.
No, it's... are you comfortable?
Yeah. Yeah.
I thought this was a nicer environment.
That's a very nice environment, sitting here on your porch.
Huh?
Sitting here on your porch. And
this is one of the reasons I can't see selling the house. I want to, as long as it's financially prudent, keep it. Spend our weekends here. It's a little harder to do in the winter. Was very lucky. How many people you know have the chance to learn epidemiology from up close with a master like John? And Alex Layton was the most complete Renaissance man you'd ever want to meet. He was a master of psychiatry, but not Freudian psychiatry, but it was the Johns Hopkins program, which was orchestrated by he was from Switzerland.
What's his last name? At Hopkins. Am I remembering Adolf at Hopkins, the man you're...
His last name was...
wasn't Meyer, was it?
Adolf Myers.
Myers.
Adolf Myers. According to Alex Layton, he was some branch of Christianity I was not familiar with. But his approach to psychiatry was, he thought Freud was very thought-provoking and brilliant, according to Alex, but he said, I don't know how to empirically develop that model. He produced what was called a Meyerian social biology model. And according to Alex Layton, the origin of that model was his observations of his mother. His mother was episodically psychotic. And his question was, why episodic? Second question was, what were the triggers? So Alex said for decades, every psychiatric resident at Hopkins had to do a Meyerian chart on every patient. What are the social situations that trigger emotional, particular specific emotional responses? So that's the tradition Alex was in and Dorothea. And there was a time when every psychiatric epidemiologist, every leader, was a product of Adolf Myers and his program. Everyone, there were about eight. I think some of that, but not all of it, is perhaps congenial to the cognitive-emotional model developed by Beck at Penn. Again, not psychoanalytic, but focusing on how you think and how you feel kind of questions. And the study thereof. He, like Freud, thought that the psychoses were overwhelmingly genetic.
I realize I didn't ask you when you met Ellen.
A mutual friend introduced us, and we went to a Playmaker production together. What was the name of the play? A classic play. And one thing led to another. That was, what, 1959? No, that was 1957. We got married in 1959. So this is our 52nd year of marriage. There's something affirming and scary of getting married before you have your degree in hand. That degree process has certain built-in anxieties, doesn't it?
It's part of the culturing.
Yeah. The yeah, 1959 at Hillel.
You got married at Hillel?
There was no synagogue here. Her parents' approach to Judaism was in the German tradition of, quote, reform. And the Hillel rabbi, was he still the Hillel rabbi? Rosenzweig? He had been, at least. Maybe he was still. He would have married us. No, that was a great blessing. And she was she had not yet, she graduated from UNC in 59 and then went to Duke for a master's in math. So if she had wanted, she could have easily gotten a PhD, but that was not. By that time, she had a job she liked. And I secondly think she came to prefer statistics over pure math. Group theory in math is very abstract, I gather.
Now, she was working at UNC in the School of Public Health for Robert
Elston.
Biostatistics. For Robert Elston?
Yeah, she wrote perhaps one of the earliest, if not the earliest, program for population genetics. And in that world, as Larry Cooper says every time he runs into us, you're famous. She is. Every meeting we've been to in other countries, Holland, China, Canada. Someone, they see her name. Ah, I use your program. She did the first program for population genetics used around the world still.
That's quite notable.
Well, she is her father's daughter. I would be happy to be as smart as she is. But I have learned to be content with what I inherited or developed. But she's still working, and her boss is pleading with her, one more year, one more year. And Ellen likes what she does. She enjoys it. So the apartment isn't all set up. That'll happen in the goodness of time. But she enjoys the world of clinical trials and the analysis thereof. And she puts those skills to work in cancer studies, cancer drug A, B, C, or D, or this or that type of cancer. My impression among people who have a passion for math, that problem solving is almost a kind of drug. You get a high.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
And I think she gets deep, deep satisfaction from results. If you ever have to have an MRI, and I hope there's no such reason, the panels on the side and across the top of that narrow, almost tomb-like space, the measurement system is based on three papers by her father. The Characteristic Root of a Matrix, the Duke Math Journal. But that's not really relevant to what your
What I wanted to, I did remember something else I wanted to ask you, which was, which school public health deans did you know?
I knew them all. We used to meet in McGavran's office. I knew Dean Mays.
So you knew Ed McGavran?
Huh?
You knew Ed McGavran?
Oh, yeah. Dean McGavran's daughter and Ellen were good friends from high school here. She also went to UNC, I think. McGavran's daughter.
I never heard anything
she
about her.
She died in a tragic auto accident.
Oh, no.
Somewhere in West Virginia. She was an official at one time of the Girl Scouts of America. I have plenty of time. I was looking because at 4 o'clock I need to do my.
I'm going to need to go also, so maybe another 15 minutes.
And okay.
I can take you.
What other questions?
So you knew Ed McGavran and you knew Dean Mays.
Yeah, they all had different styles and agendas. They all made major, major contributions in their own way.
Is that your telephone, by the way, or is that across the... Oh, that's your telephone. Yeah.
Yep. It is.
I think it may be Ellen, actually.
No.
Bert, I can drive you over to Carol Woods. Ellen doesn't have to come because I can drive you to Carol Woods.
Yeah, he'll take you back to Carol Woods. Yep. Okay. Love you. Take care. Recognize her voice. I have a
little loss of hearing in the right ear, but not the left. When I talk to Daniel, who has a very soft voice, I have to switch to the left. I'm going to get my hearing checked soon anyhow, but the School of Public Health was blessed with great leadership and great faculty. There was one thing that always puzzled me about the School of Public Health and the respective departments. Ten percent, I used to be told consistently that only 10% of the budget of the School of Public Health was hard money from the state. And I was also told one of the reasons for that, from the point of view of Bill Friday, he was very much supportive of the School of Public Health. That's where his wife got her degree, health education. But he says I told Bernie, whom I have nothing but enormous respect for, you all have so many projects. This was a time when there are all these population programs in different parts of the world. It's very hard for me to go to the state legislature and argue for this or that budget allocation when so much of your assets are devoted in Indonesia and God knows where else. I mean, the questions I get is, what are you doing for North Carolina? Mm-hmm. If you want North Carolina money, you've got to demonstrate North Carolina contributions. You could argue that's a very narrow view of what a university is about, but he says that's what legislators bring, their own constituents. Now, every dean had his own gifts, his own contributions. I think that Bernie was special. Of all the deans, he had by far the larger national reputation. He was a member of the Institute of Medicine. He was had more public recognition than anyone else. Not doesn't take away from others, but all made their contributions. But Bernie knew everybody. Was incredibly smart. He and John Graham founded the Population Center because over a series of luncheons they had decided this is an area the university needs to be involved in. I don't think any of the other deans, quote, started anything on that scale. Again, I'm not diminishing anybody. I just think Bernie was a special case of the intellectual builder, entrepreneur. So it's not accidental that the starter dean with a vision and Bernie's name are on the new building. And Rosenau's is on the first part because he was the first dean. And when you walk into the older building of the Harvard School of Public Health, there's a big portrait of him. Lucy Morgan told me that he was a gem to work with. I never met him. The School of Public Health was very good for me. I thought that if the leadership of ever made a big mistake was in not rewarding David Kleinbaum appropriately. He revolutionized how epidemiology is taught, wrote the textbook, the textbook. He told me he got a $30,000 raise going to Emory. In a way, that's not necessarily a judgment on anybody, but rather the politics of that environment.
Well, it's the politics, and I think it's also where the money comes from.
Yeah.
You know, there's so much state money, and if you use it up on teachers, then you have less to use to invest in research, in getting research funded, and getting research
funded is the way
to bring money into the schools.
Right.
So
right.
I feel a little guilty about taking up as much state money as I do. So
my only advice to young faculty or middle-aged faculty is make damn sure you have multiple sources of retirement income. You cannot rely on just the state income.
Well, now there's a concern that the state may not be able to pay the health care for retirees. I mean, it's not being presently discussed. Ralph Campbell had a column in the paper yesterday or whatever when he talked about North Carolina's fiscal obligations going forward. And you've got this large cohort of people who are going to be retiring, you know, the baby boom essentially, all these state employees, and the state has not been fully funding its retirement obligations, and that includes the health care, which currently is covered. So
does that include people like me, or
right now? I mean, it's as I say, nothing has been said about not paying for people, you know, not fulfilling their obligations. But what I think there was some kind of a conference, and Erskine Bowles spoke at it. He said, you know, there is the possibility that the country could actually not be able to meet its obligations, that our debt is so great now, and the deficit so great, and the ability to rein it in, the political ability, that there is a concern, and that this is true for various states as well. And although North Carolina is in much better shape than a number of other states, you know, for some time, the in order to get the budget to balance, they've not been fully funding the retirement system. You know, it's interesting. I mean, you studied economics, as I did, and I keep trying to understand economics. It's very hard, from an evolutionary standpoint, to compile resources for the future.
Yep.
You know, you can do it, and you need to do it up to a point. But as the as those resources being put aside are bigger and bigger, I think it's very hard to defend them. You know, it's just, you know, evolution, I think, works with the present very, very strongly. And so when you have something like the baby boom, which is going to incur this very substantial future liability, but we as a society, you're not baby boomer, but the baby boomers, when they were bringing in all this money during the 1990s, when the economy was booming and wealth was just mushrooming, and yet it wasn't being put into things that would carry the future nearly as much as it needed to be.
Well, if that happens, if I'm affected significantly, we can always say goodbye to Carol Woods and live out the rest of our days here and get whatever help, buy whatever help we need.
I don't actually know that Carol Woods will be in any way. I don't know that Carol Woods will be in any worse shape, because Carol Woods has a financial model where people put in capital in the beginning, and then that partly carries their future.
Yeah.
So I don't know that it's a Carol Woods issue, but from a state perspective,
yeah.
You know, the entitlement system in the federal government, can we afford to do Medicare? We have a very expensive approach to doing things in this country. You know, we don't want to avoid any kind of treatment that somebody might need. That person should get it, and the cost is not really considered.
Well, that's poor planning.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, there's no other area of life where we say it doesn't matter whether you can't afford it. You should have it. I mean, housing, food, clothing, whatever. But we want to do that with medical care. And that would be okay if we were willing to restrain the level of medical care. But we also don't want to restrain it. And of course, we have the corporate, you know, it's a huge way to make money. So the corporations want to constantly increase the technology and disseminate it and so on. So it's a model, you know, our economic models really need to be readjusted, realigned.
Oh, I know.
And we've had a lot of trouble doing that as a society. I don't know if you read Samuelson's book. Is it Robert Samuelson?
Yeah.
You actually invited him down here once when you were on the speakers committee, I think.
Right.
Well, he wrote this book. I can't remember what it's called now. I read it about 10 years or so ago, in which he points out that the U.S. is not does not have the kind of economic future that we want to have, because whereas other countries have been educating their populations, the U.S. has been letting our population education decline even.
Yep.
And why would we expect people in the United States to earn so much more than people elsewhere with comparable education and skills.
Right.
Well, after World War II, you could understand why, and for many years after that. But what's happened now is it's catching up. And so I think that there's going to be, I mean, essentially what we're watching is the U.S. economic, particularly the workforce, rewards are going to be going down. I mean, they've come down. The outsourcing overseas and so on is one of the mechanisms by which that happens. But we can't expect to always be the best paid workers on the planet. Or if even if they're the best, we're the best paid, we're not going to be the best paid by the orders of magnitude that we have been. So it's a shame that we haven't used the affluence that we had, and we still don't use it, to invest in the ways that would make for a better future than we have.
No, that's very sad. You say you have to...
Yeah, I probably... I need to